Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guests are the president and CEO emeritus of the National World War II Museum in New Orleans, Nick Mueller, and the senior fellow for national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and Foreign Affairs, columnist extraordinaire Max Booth. Now, remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. You also can get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. Tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Delete Me, Quince, Hers, WL, and 3 Day Blinds in our episode show notes. We really thank you for supporting them because these sponsors are what help make this podcast happen. And we have a treat for you coming up to celebrate the 250th. We're going to have you respond to another survey in celebration of America's 250th. Over the next month, we want you to answer which member of the Trump administration is so bad that the founding fathers were here to see them, they would send them back to England or not. Your choices are going to be Pete Hegseth, Todd Blanche, Scott Bessent, Stephen Miller, and Kash Patel. We had a fun time with that survey a year ago. I think this one will be a perfect way to celebrate the 250th, and we'll announce the results the week of July 4th. To vote, answer using the survey link in the episode show notes. The polls are open, and you have a month to vote. James, I think Tuesday was a good night for the Democrats, with California the least relevant in many ways. To start in the East, in New Jersey, in the 7th Congressional District, the Democrats chose a mainstream progressive, Rebecca Bennett, a former Navy helicopter pilot and commander, Mikey Sherrill Jr. with stripes. She's going to beat the absent incumbent Republican Tom Kaine. This will be the first time I've ever been ahead of Dave Wasserman, but New Jersey CD7 put it in the D column. Out in Iowa, Josh Turek, the vigorous former Special Olympian, wins the Senate nomination easily. He's the strongest Senate candidate they've had out there since Tom Harkin. And the state auditor, Rob Sand, you were the first person to really rave about what a special politician Rob Sand was. He's going to win that governor's race, and I think there's at least a 50-50 chance that he carries Turek in with him. Iowa is a state that has turned deep red in the last 15 years, and I think it's now they have better candidates. They're not latching on to some of the divisive cultural issues, and I think it's turning purple. Thirdly, Montana, that's the sleeper. Democrats can't win a head-to-head race in Montana. That, you know, two great candidates, John Tester and Steve Bullock, lost. But independent Scott Bodner, the former president of the University of Montana with the best resume since Thomas Jefferson, can, if it's a two-way contest. Republicans spent a lot of money trying surreptitiously, which Democrats do also, trying to help the one Democratic candidate who emphatically said should stay in. She lost. The winner's a good candidate, but may well be smart enough to do what happened in Nebraska and drop out sometime this summer to clear the way for Scott Bodner. That would really put that state in play, which no one expected beforehand. I don't have much to say about California. Nothing really a surprise. Nothing much will change. They'll elect a Dell Democratic governor in November. James, tell me where I'm right or wrong.
I think you're right in everything, but there are three things that I'd like to add on to your observations. I disagree with none of them. First, let's go to Iowa. Josh Turek, the guy that he beat, his stick was he was against Schumer. It was against the establishment Democrats in Washington. That was his kind of cachet, if you will. That didn't work. But the big news was the Republican gubernatorial primary. Remember, right. Trump had been on a tear all over the country. He did anything he told Republicans to vote for. And as you know, Al, this show has always been of the view that there's a premium for Democrats in swing states. In other words, if we run 5 points ahead of expected performance in non-farm states, we're going to run 7.5 in farm states because the anger and the hurt there is so deep. And boy, when the Republicans endorse Trump candidate, but there was guys in Congress, he gets beat. That shows you how deep this runs. That from California, well, I would add to your argument in the LA mayor's race, Karen Bass, obviously going to win. Spencer Pratt is going to be a personality to watch in national Republican politics. He may run for president because he looked like the guy in LA. He stood up. He was brave. He did this, that. So that, I think that it shows that the Democrats, you know, are not so interested in the establishment and that kind of stuff. That in, you know, Josh, we had him on a show. He worked day in, day out. Rob Sand is like, he's one of the few people that I've seen that I'd mention the same breath with Bill Clinton and Barack Obama or even Reagan. But Rob Sand might be that good. And, you're right. A lot of it was gratifying. And I think at the end of the night, it showed Democrats didn't want to win. And that's the most important thing about the night.
Yeah. And, two slightly down notes in that California Central Valley District, David Valadao is the incumbent Republican. He's tough to beat. But unfortunately, I think the best candidate didn't win there. The left-wing candidate won, single payer, still may be able to win in November. It will be harder. But the only other the bit of bad news, a little disturbing news to me, is out of Maine, Graham Plattner. James, what worries me is not what has occurred so far, but what's going to occur in the future. I mean, it seems to me something kind of bad happens every several weeks. The latest was sexting. Nothing that's happened so far should disqualify him from beating Susan Collins, but he handles it badly. His wife confirmed that he had sexted a couple years ago. That's not a great political sin. But he then, rather than acknowledge it and say, hey, I made a mistake, our marriage is strong, said, oh, the press is out to get me. So I really worry about that a lot. I worry about what else is going to happen. But otherwise, it was a very, very sunny evening.
So let's go back to Graham Plattner. And to be fair, I call it endorse. I did a video for Governor Janet Mills, who subsequently dropped out because she's still on the ballot. The more I think about the Graham Plattner thing, the more that I see that he has value. Okay, Graham Plattner had 4 combat deployments. I don't want to diagnose someone, but we have to assume that that has had some residual effect on him. Somebody says PTSD, I don't know.
Clearly.
Shell shock. But what all those 4 wars have in common? Susan Collins was for all 4. Maybe it would not be the worst thing. Maybe if you were voting for governor and you had to have instant judgment or stability, maybe it's actually an affirmatively good thing that we have a combat veteran who is affected by the rigors and horror of combat on the floor of the United States Senate, serving on the Veterans Affairs Committee, serving on the Committee for Mental Health. I think that the walk that this guy has taken is a walk, is in some ways a noble walk. And he came back and, he's oyster fisherman, he earned his living with his hands. He's a little bit of an odd duck. I could see that.
That's not a disqualifier, James.
Right. The tattoo, okay, I never got a tattoo because I just think they're permanent. Do stupid shit. And anybody listen to this, I told my daughter, if you ever get a tattoo, I'd rather you take crack cocaine. And you stuck with what you thought X number of years ago. The sexting scandal, I'm a little bit like you. I hope that, the accumulation of this doesn't weigh too heavily. But there's nothing about him that I don't think you would expect for somebody who's had a similar experience in him. And I'm just warming up to, he might be the right person at the right time for the right job.
Yeah, I think it's possible. And on the tattoo, I think it's he has a very easy rejoinder in any debate. Look, I did what might be a very stupid thing during a war that you voted for, Susan Collins. I think that's, you know, a much greater sin. I am more worried about the sexting, not in itself, but just whether it's a drip drip. But, you know, we'll see.
So, I want to make a point. I was looking up and talking to someone. I said, did Susan Collins vote for the big bad bill? Because I don't want to. And it's worse than you think. She didn't vote for it. Okay, you know that. But she voted for the rule. If that's not having it both ways and looking for the most chicken shit flexible way out. It actually, when I thought I had it, when they said, no, she voted against it. Shit, man, I thought I had her. And then when I found out she voted for rule, I got, hey, Susan, I got you worse than you thought. I mean, that's a great, Thune goes to her and says, I got to have you vote on the rule. You can, you know, I got Lisa and I got, you know, such and such lined up. I don't need you on the final, but what bullshit, that's Collin-esque duplicity if I ever saw it. I don't think Graham Platten would ever do that.
James, she was for it before she was against it, to coin a whole phrase. I mean, you're right. I want to bring up something else. As much as I have disagreed with Supreme Court decisions, I haven't gone as far as you in calling them unfit, and the court has to be radically changed. I may do a limited, at least, apology and acknowledge you may well have been right. This week, the six Republicans overturning a three-judge panel's decision said Alabama can intentionally discriminate in its congressional districts. They may not put it that way, but that's exactly what it does. It overturned that panel. Now, let me just say, it was a three-judge panel. The three judges included two who were appointed by Trump, and the third was initially appointed by Ronald Reagan. This was not a left-wing panel. And they, after studying the matter extensively, said the Republicans intentionally discriminated against blacks in their redistricting. But it was a really compelling case. Unanimous, these three Republicans, and this court took it up, and within a week, they said, hey, privately, you know, I'm sorry. Much more important than that, we got to help Republicans. They may as well register as a Republican PAC, James. That was just a disgraceful decision.
Well, and if you, to the extent that they gave you read, they were actually irritated at them.
Yeah,
they were irritated. And Justice Sotomayor wrote up. I read about her dissent. I didn't read the whole thing, obviously, and it was scathing. And I'm just saying, and I'll say this forever. There is no reason to give them any respect. If they make a decision, a law, you have to follow it. But don't ever, ever, ever think that it's legitimate. You just have to do it because that's the law. They are so not just ideologically bought and paid for, financially bought and paid for. The only people in the entire United States government that operate with no ethical restraints or the president of the United States, a singular person, I guess a vice president, I'm not sure, that's the executive branch, and the Supreme Court. And God damn it, if the Democrats don't come up with something, and we should, to strengthen this kind of disclosure and the stuff, and let our friend Fred Wertheimer work on that. And yeah, I don't know if you can impose a code of ethics on a separate branch of government. I doubt that you can, but you know, they come to you for funding. You can do a lot of things, but never ever respect these people. Ever.
Yeah, you know, I agree. The final point I'd make is that and we can discuss this in more depth with Max Boot, because he's an expert on such things. Trump named Bill Pulte a really, I mean, you know, it is absolutely laughable if it weren't so tragic to head national intelligence while still keeping his housing job. Now, in his housing job, all he did was really serve as a hitman for Trump, combing through mortgages to see if he could find some Democrats that they could, you know, go after. He is a man of no reputation. He had controversy in private business. He's been a disgrace as a public official. He is totally unqualified for this post. And I tell you, the danger is Trump can keep him there as an acting director for like 210 days. And I will guarantee you sometime in those 210 days, he's going to say national intelligence, you know, shows that basically foreigners are trying to help Democrats win this election. He is a he is a man lacking in integrity, and it's a disgraceful appointment, and it shows the contempt, the utter contempt that Trump has for the American intelligence community.
Well, I'm trying to I agree with everything you say. I don't know if you I'm trying to think. I don't know. You can't say it any better. If he's there for one reason, the Republican senators would love that they put him up for confirmation. They'd love to take that'd be an easy vote,
right?
The Susan Collins is to vote no,
right?
And thank God. I hope so. They're gonna leave this guy in there. He's got one job to do everything he can to fuck with the election on the behalf of Trump,
right?
It, you know, I always say if I don't know if Trump is a traitor, but he would do everything that a traitor would do. So if you were a traitor president, you'd put an idiot in the Director of National Intelligence oversees all everything. He's the central, he's big in the CIA, he's big in the FBI.
And has access to it all.
And this is what you would do if you were trying to destroy the country. And of course, he's straight. I think, and I fundamentally believe this, Trump hates the United States. And this is just more evidence.
Well, it's a dreadful appointment. We will talk more about it with Max. James, we have on one of our favorite guests, Max Boot, one of the most insightful columnists on foreign policy and a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Max, the Trump-Iran policy vacillates, sometimes hourly. Here's my take, and you will forget more than I know, so I want you to, you know, react to that and tell me where I'm right or wrong. I think Trump desperately wants out as soon as possible. This was such an ill-conceived escapade. But he wants to claim, with some acceptance, that he's got a good deal, better than Obama, it has to be. That's not going to happen. So tell me where he is and whether that's on the mark or not.
I completely agree with your analysis, Al. I think that's exactly what's going on. I think basically two things going on. That's one thing. He needs a nuclear deal that he can claim as quote-unquote better than Obama. And at the moment, he's struggling to get there. And the other thing is, he needs a deal to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, preferably without Iran charging tolls, which would be very embarrassing for him because, of course, they were not charging tolls prior to his ill-fated war. So essentially, this is now, a war for Trump to save face or try to save face. But I think the reality is that the reality he's not grappling with is he's lost. The U.S. has lost the war, and he needs to come to grips with that. But he's struggling to come to grips with that because he needs to claim as this massive victory. And unfortunately, if he makes the compromises to end the war that Iran is demanding, our defeat will become, you know, self-evident, and he doesn't want to admit that.
No, I think it will, Max. He will never admit he lost. He hadn't admitted he lost the 2020 election.
Right.
So we know he will never admit that. But again, as you suggest, he doesn't have any good options. I mean, resuming the bombing, you know, it didn't bring him to their knees, and there will be retaliation. He could get out quickly and declare a victory, even if no one believes him. Or he can keep going and hope the Iranians will collapse, but they're not going to collapse.
Right.
So he really, I don't think he has any really wise people around him who have an impact on him. So I think he's just kind of stumbling now.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's kind of interesting because for like 2 weeks now, we've been constantly hearing leaks. Oh, there's a deal that's been done. It's on the verge of being concluded at just a few minor technical things, et cetera, et cetera. But then when this first came out a couple of weeks ago, there was a meltdown on the right. You had Senator Roger Wicker, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. You had Lindsey Graham. You had a lot of right-wing pundits saying, this is a sellout. This is worse than Obama. And I think Trump got spooked by that and backed off and tried to toughen up the deal. But unfortunately, the Iranians are not willing to play ball. And so we're basically at an impasse.
So on Hormuz, Max, I guess it's a argument as to who can incur the pain the longest, blocking the straits and really damaging the whole global economy versus a Iran blockade, which hurts them. Who will say I can't take this any longer sooner?
Well, that's exactly right. I agree with everything you're saying, Al. I don't know why you need me. I think you're on the money because. It really is which side has the higher...
Man, if you help my reputation, Max, I got to tell you.
It's really which side has the higher pain threshold. And as I've been saying for a while, my money is on the mullahs. I mean, these are the guys who are willing to slaughter thousands of their own citizens to stay in power. Do they really care if their country is getting poorer? All they care about is hanging on to power and avoiding, you know, this embarrassing and costly defeat. Whereas Trump... has reason to be nervous. His popularity is in the toilet. The midterms are approaching. He's been able to stave off economic Armageddon so far, in part by not constantly leaking that the conflict is about to end. And so, you know, bolstering the stock market and keeping oil prices lower than they might otherwise be. But to a large extent, we've been living off the oil reserves, which have been accumulated before the crisis, and those reserves are running out. And so, you know, I'm listening to economists and oil industry experts who are saying that if this is not resolved by July, oil prices are going to skyrocket, that we could be looking at 150 a barrel, 200 a barrel. That's going to be very bad for American consumers at the height of the summer driving season. It's going to be very bad for the inflation rate. It's going to be very bad for the economy overall. It's going to be really bad for Republicans in the midterm elections. And you might say, maybe Trump doesn't care about the midterms. He's not on the ballot. But I think he does care because he understands that the more Democrats there are, the more likely he's going to get impeached again.
Yeah, I'm not sure he'll get impeached, but he'll certainly be held accountable. And that's the one thing he cannot stand. But there were stories this week about a supposedly explosive phone conversation between Trump and Bibi Netanyahu. A couple of points. It seems that our interests are no longer the same, at least as of now. And Netanyahu may think this is the time to finish off the enemies. But Israel is paying a price. It's become a pariah around the world. And its once strong bipartisan political support in America is vanishing. What's the significance of all of this, Max?
I sort of miss the old Bibi Netanyahu, who is always hawkish, but he used to be a cautious hawk. And people forget this, that before October 7th, he wasn't out there starting wars all the time. When he did use military force, it was, you know, so-called mowing the grass operations, where he would bomb Hezbollah or Hamas for a few days and then end it and go back to normal. But since October 7th, he has displayed this kind of messianic complex where he's out, as he says repeatedly, to redraw the map of the Middle East. He wants to change, defeat all of Israel's enemies at once and transform the region. Well, that is a sure path to endless war and futility. And that's kind of where Israel is today. The Israeli armed forces, kind of like the U.S. armed forces, have tremendous tactical competence. They can hit targets, they can kill people, all that kind of stuff, but they can't translate those tactical results into strategic or political gains. And that's what Netanyahu is struggling with. And the result of his desire to wage war on Iran and everybody else is he is making Israel more dependent upon the U.S. than ever before, because he can't fight Iran without massive U.S. support. And that means that he is now the junior partner in this relationship with Trump. And that's how Trump is treating him. Trump is basically saying, like, you do what I say or else. So he's treating him as basically like one of the ground crew at Mar-a-Lago. And in the meantime, American public opinion has turned against Israel. So the long-term consequences for Israel, I think, are going to be very costly.
The only thing I'd add, it is, you know, messianic, I suspect. It's also stay out of jail. He has an election this year, and he's hoping, from what I hear, this is not going to turn that around, but that's at least what he's hoping for.
Yes.
But James Carville.
All right, so Britt, you alluded to two things. First, we know prior to this incursion or whatever he calls it, there was pretty good dissatisfaction with the regime in Iran. And we get information out. I never know how reliable it is, but we're videos and people, more than a few people, particularly in Tehran, as always in the cities, and particularly younger people, were just in fury. As a result of this, is the regime weakened, strengthened, or about the same?
Hard to know long term. I think in the short term, it's been strengthened. Remember when Trump launched this war on February 28th, his message was to the people of Iran, rise up, your hour of liberation is at hand, take over your government. Well, that clearly has not happened. And I think what we're seeing is that despite the damage that Iran has suffered, the regime is very much entrenched and they're able to continue operating. They're able to continue repressing the population. And I was just listening to an Iran expert say that in his view, the extreme violence with which the Iranian regime put down these demonstrations in January, killing literally thousands of people, has had a deterrence effect. It's dissuaded people from coming out into the streets again. And so now you have a new generation. I mean, Trump talked about regime change and he was going to pick the new leader in Iran and all that kind of stuff. Well, what's happened, of course, is that we have a new generation of hardliners, including the old Ayatollah's son, who's now the supreme leader, and this clique of IRGC generals who are very much hardliners who are now in control of the regime, and they feel like they're winning the war and they don't need to make compromises, and there's certainly no indications of any revolutionary ferment against the regime. So this war seems to have backfired in every way imaginable.
So let's turn our attention to Israel. For a long time, and I've worked in Israel, and a lot of people like me are delighted that there's a Jewish state in Eastern Mediterranean. And a friend of mine is a consultant, not that it matters, but she happens to be Jewish. Okay, I happen to be. I feel stupid even saying it, but that's okay. And she says, this is the first Israeli government that doesn't even try to get America to like it. All right, you know, you used to get the talking points. It was a beacon of democracy. It was in the Middle East. It was a force for stability. There were Arabs in the Knesset. And some of them were pretty good. It looks like his government is doing everything it can to get you not to like them. You know, I mean, they're losing support. Self-described Jews under 35 have left the house. Okay. And I'm getting, and I've always told people there's a difference. If you don't like the policies of the government of Israel, that does not make you an anti-Semite, because 47.5% of the people who live in Israel agree with you. Okay. But how do you see a way that Israel, it could be a change of leadership and maybe a change of strategy to protect itself as it must, but to not go out of its way to make itself this international toxic pariah or whatever you want to call it, but you're doing
that. It's going to be very hard to undo the damage that I think Netanyahu and his government are doing. I mean, if you look at the Gallup poll or the Pew poll, they're showing that we've kind of reached the crossover point where more Americans are sympathetic to the Palestinians than they are to the Israelis. And that's an earthquake in public opinion terms. That's never been the case before, and now it's the case.
I think my opinion has changed, more than just a T90 bit. And, you know, but the one thing I'll point, man, I don't want to turn it back to you. I just want to make one point. We've pumped billions and billions of dollars since Camp David into the Iron Dome, God knows, how airplanes, F-18s, 22s, whatever else. And I do think the United States has earned the right for the government of Israel to say, look, we support you all the way. You're going to have to try to give us a little bit of help here and to do things that are not. But the next president, particularly if it's a Democrat, is going to have a very, in a diplomatic terms, a frank and lengthy discussion with whoever is the head of the government of Israel, because something's got to change. Domestic politics, this is the one thing that could stop a Democratic huge win in November. I'm starting to worry that this whole Israeli-Palestinian thing is going to could have some effect in Democratic primaries and cause people to do the less than wise thing. But that was on my soap opera.
I think there's no question we're never going to have another president as pro-Israel as the last two, as Biden and Trump. There is much more skepticism about Israel and in both parties, even Republicans under the age of 50 and pretty much the rest of the electorate. They're all very skeptical of Israel right now. And part of that is, I think, a miscalculation on Bibi's part, because, you know, he has really hitched his wagon to the MAGA train. And he's all about getting along with Trump and all about appealing to the MAGA base, which he has done. I mean, that's kind of the core of Israel's support right now. But that's, you know, like a quarter of the U.S. population, something like that. And everybody else has been completely alienated by Israel's behavior, especially the fact that they, you know, kind of the seemingly indiscriminate bombing where they don't seem to care about civilian casualties, in part because they've been radicalized by October 7th, which was Israel's 9/11. So they're trying to achieve security. But the cost of trying to achieve security is actually to make Israel less secure in the long term by doing major damage to the U.S.-Israel alliance, which has always been, you know, going back for decades, the bedrock of Israeli security.
Thank you very much for taking time to speak with us. Al, I'll turn it over to you to close us out.
Yeah, I got a few more. Max, this administration has made a number of bad appointments. We know that. Hegseth, Patel, and others. This week, they named Bill Pulte to be the acting director of national intelligence. He has, not only does he not have any intelligence background, he's been a political hitman and a total Trump loyalist. What message does this appointment send to the American intelligence community?
Well, I'll get to that in a second, but I will first say I'm just impressed by how Trump keeps lowering the bar of competence. I mean, I thought that Tulsi Gabbard was bad enough, but Bill Pulte is even worse. He has literally no experience. His only qualification is that, you know, serving at the Home Loan Board, he went after Trump's enemies, which is exactly, presumably, what Trump is looking for from the intelligence community. I mean, it's terrifying. He does not meet the statutory requirements. That he's being appointed is basically an indication to me that Trump wants to weaponize the intelligence community for his own political purposes. And I can't imagine what the actual, professional intelligence officers at the Office of the Director of National Intelligence or elsewhere throughout the IC. I can't imagine what they're thinking. I mean, this is just appalling. I hope that we will see some serious Senate Republican pushback on this, as there has been on the weaponization fund. But of course, the fact that he's appointing Pulte as acting director means that he doesn't have to be confirmed. So there's only a limited amount that the Senate can do, but I think they can push back and, you know, hold the funding, do other things to make
exactly
clear that this is not acceptable.
Exactly. As acting, he gets at least 210 days, and he could do a lot of damage in that. But I think you're absolutely right that the only weapon they really have against this is funding, is looking at some of those appropriations. And I don't know if they'll do that, but it is a terrifying appointment. Let me just switch to what I think is the most important conflict going on in the world, which is Ukraine, doing a remarkable job of taking on the invading Russians. They're now, you know, actually pleading with us just for some more missiles. We are starting to win. There are reports that Putin has been told the Russian economy can't take this for much longer. What's holding up any further aid to Ukraine right now?
I think it's Donald Trump. I mean, he's been the obstacle all along. I mean, I will say that if you had told me, you know, a year ago that Trump was going to end all new U.S. aid to Ukraine, I would be a lot more concerned about the state of the war than I actually am right now, because Ukraine has shown tremendous resilience, inventiveness, courage, tenacity, and ability to fight back against the Russians, even while they've been largely cut off by the Americans. And they are getting a lot of European aid, but they've built up maybe the greatest military drone industry in the world. They're producing like 7 million drones a year, which is a lot more than we're producing. So they're doing a tremendous job of fighting back, and they are having some success. They aren't just holding the line, they're actually starting to push the Russians back a little bit. But their biggest vulnerability is, although they've developed great drone defenses and much better than what we have, they need Patriot batteries to defend against Russian ballistic missiles. and they just don't have enough right now. And President Zelensky has been begging for those. They've even asked for permission to manufacture them because they know we don't have enough Patriots because Trump has used them up recklessly in this war of choice against Iran. But the Ukrainians are very technically adept. They could manufacture the Patriot missile on their own if they had a license from the U.S., but Trump refuses to grant them that license, and he's not, as far as I know, sending new Patriots. And so the result of that is Ukrainian cities, Kiev and others, are very vulnerable to Russian ballistic missile strikes right now. And so you've seen the last few weeks, these massive Russian missile strikes that are targeted on civilian areas that are killing civilians. These are terrible war crimes, which are being enabled by the Trump administration because they're not providing Ukraine with the air defense interceptors they need to protect their population.
Max, final question. You wrote, a very important, I mean, we talk about Ukraine, we talk about the Middle East, we sometimes talk about Asia. Kind of overarching is the question of alliances, which Trump has basically abandoned. And you wrote a column this week and that appeared in the Washington Post that said that long run, this may be one of his greatest sins.
Yeah, he's really taken a wrecking ball to American alliances wherever you look in the world. I think the damage has been the worst in Europe. I mean, it might be irreparable at this point after Trump threatened to annex Greenland, and the Danes in January were actually getting ready to fight U.S. troops if they invaded Greenland. I mean, that's just mind-boggling, like two NATO allies getting ready to square off. And of course, he's been nonstop abusive of NATO during the Iran war for not bailing him out of this reckless war of choice. Now he's moving some U.S. troops out of Europe, but he's also doing damage to U.S. alliances elsewhere. He's now put U.S. aid to Taiwan on hold after his love-in with Xi Jinping, which is causing, I think, U.S. allies in Asia to wonder about how much they can count on the U.S. in the future. And then meanwhile, in the Middle East, he's actually very close to these Persian Gulf states because they do lucrative business deals with him. But he's kind of left them out in the cold also because he pushed them into the front lines of this war against Iran that they didn't ask for. And now they're very concerned he's going to abandon them, make a deal with Iran that still leaves Iran as a major threat to the region. So they're basically going to be at the mercy of Iran after Trump riled them up and showed, and the Iranians showed how they can control the Strait of Hormuz. So, wherever you look, the only alliance at the moment that seems to be in good shape is the U.S.-Israel alliance. Everywhere else, Trump is causing massive damage. As I said, he's kind of doing to U.S. alliances what he's already done to the East Wing of the White House.
Good point. James, you got anything else you want to
add? I have just one observation. I read, but I can't validate it, that part of the enabling legislation for the Director of National Intelligence is that they have to have some intelligence background.
Extensive, yes. National security background, yeah.
Right.
Experience.
If that's the case, and of course they're not going to ever give a confirmation vote on this guy, they're just going to keep him in that. Somebody, to me, and I'm a bad lawyer, but somebody could sue that this appointment, you have to stop it because it's not in accordance with the enabling legislation. Maybe you can beat this on legal grounds. I don't know, but I think it's worth a try.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, that's the one place where we've seen consistent checks and balances on Trump is in the courts.
Maybe.
For sure.
James, I actually did some reporting on that yesterday. And the problem, I mean, it's certainly a strong case. The problem is one of standing. Who has standing to bring that? Members of Congress don't, perhaps. I mean, certainly some of the junior people at the in the intelligence agency could, but they wouldn't have a job for very long if they did.
Standing is a very difficult thing. I always had trouble with it. Jurisdiction's very hard. But if it's a law of Congress, maybe a member could say, have standing to say, I'm trying to enforce a law that was passed by this guy. I don't know. We'll talk about it. We can try. I'm sure smarter people than me are thinking about this. But I thank you, Max. And I was correct. That is part of the neighbor legislation that you sure just can't get somebody off the turnip truck and say, hey, you're the DNI.
Right. I mean, the other outrage I would throw out to you is the fact that the U.S. military continues carrying out these extrajudicial killings, blowing up alleged drug runner boats in the Caribbean and the Pacific. And I think there's a consensus of legal experts that this is illegal. This is basically killing suspected criminals without trial. But how do you stop it? And that's the same issue of standing is, can somebody sue and do they have the standing to intervene and try to get the courts involved? Very hard to do.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Max Boot, boy, we learn a lot every time you're on. You are one of our favorite guests, and you do elevate us at least temporarily. So thank you very much. Hey, James, our guest is someone you know, Nick Muller, President Emeritus of the World War II Museum in New Orleans. We are talking a couple days before the 82nd anniversary of D-Day, the largest amphibious landing in history, leading to the Allied victory in World War II. Nick, my wife and I, courtesy of James and Mary, visited the World War II Museum several years ago. We were blown away. Everything. I mean, I don't know why I expected the European exhibits, but the Pacific exhibits were just as compelling. The idea that you and Stephen Ambrose had for this museum was brilliant, but it was a tough slog in the beginning, wasn't it?
Well, it was. And be careful how much you drink with your friends when you have a good idea. Too much sherry that afternoon. And it was this little small idea for a little D-Day museum out on Lake Pontchartrain, right by the University of New Orleans, where Andrew Higgins tested the landing craft. Yeah, it was a tough slug. We had about 10 years. We didn't know what the hell we were doing. And we had a nonprofit board. I got $4 million from courtesy of Congress, from Congressman Bob Livingston, who thought it was a great idea, just like I did. And so anyhow, it was hard raising money, and we didn't have any real federal ongoing support. We were part of the Smithsonian or the State Museum network. We were just a nonprofit with a big idea, and you hung around long enough and good things started to happen. So we opened on June 6, 2000. So the idea was came in 1990 in Steve Ambrose's backyard or mine. Anyhow.
With a few drinks.
Few drinks, yeah. The drinks, but everybody has those kind of epiphanies, you know, in bars. I will say the difference between a hallucination and a success is money.
Nick, my wife and I last year went to Normandy. I had not been there. She had. But God, what an experience. And standing on Omaha Beach and realizing that, you know, what was it, 81 years ago, 156,000 Americans, Canadians, and Brits were coming across that channel, and you looked up and you saw those fortifications, that Atlantic Wall the Germans had built with the fast-firing guns and the concrete barriers. I mean, the courage coming across on those Higgins boats, it just blows you away. But what shocked me was realizing in all that danger, 156,000 coming across, only 4,400 died. Which just shows you how beautifully planned it was, I think.
It was. It was a damn close-run thing. I mean, Bradley almost pulled off at pull him off the beaches at 10:30 when the 116th Infantry Regiment was getting annihilated. And you know, most of that unit was killed before they got to the beach. So things were really a mess at the beginning, but fortunately he didn't make that call, and we made it, and we got basically ashore at every place in Utah Beach, Omaha, all of them, the British, the Canadian beaches, and it was it's an epic conflict, a battle. I mean, I like to compare it to the Battle of Marathon, which also, you know, David and Goliath's story. With this mighty, you know, Herodotus tells us 5 million man army coming against these pesky Greeks defending their shoreline. But it was an amphibious assault too that failed. So then you got 1066. You got a few great battles in Western history that will always be remembered. And this is one of them.
Boy, it sure is. But you know what? We were lucky. We actually had the Eisenhower's guide, who was unbelievable. Yeah. And as much as we were struck by standing on Omaha Beach and the cemeteries, and we then went to some of those little places where the battles took place in the days and weeks later. And one I always remember, and I'm going to mispronounce the name, a little village called, I think it's called Angerville All Plain. I'm sure I've screwed up that. But that's where the 101st Airborne came in early that morning. They took the village. Two young American medics set up an infirmary in the church. The Germans took it back that afternoon and killed most of the people. The German commander went in the church and was so shocked that the American medics were treating Germans as well as Americans. He said, the church is off limits. And one of those, we found out, one of those young Americans is actually buried in that cemetery now. Yeah. You are a great storyteller. That was a story that just, I mean, tell us another story like that, because it's just remarkable.
Well, the airborne guys came down also in another little town just about 10 miles from St. Mary Glees, and they landed on the outside of a chateau, which was the German headquarters, about 1 or 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning. By the time they got to the walls of this castle, the German commander of the whole Cotentin Peninsula, who was in charge of all the German troops, had been on his way down to Brittany for maneuvers. And he's heard something going on. The paratroopers are landing, and he didn't know what it was. He drove back, and these airborne guys were just standing outside the walls, and this German staff car comes up with the general in it. They didn't know who was in it. They unloaded on him. They killed the first general of the war, was killed just because he was driving in the wrong place, and our guys were there and killed him right outside the Chateau Berneville. And a few weeks before that, you had General Rommel was there visiting, and so we have pictures of that of Rommel standing on coming down the steps of that chateau. You know, if he'd been there, he'd have been toast too. So it was another one of the famous moments, and that led to the confusion of the German defenses. They didn't have their general was dead. They didn't even know it for 2 days. They just said no, he was not communicating.
And he was an important general.
Yeah, General Folly. Yeah, he was. That was it's a great story. And then there are lots of tremendous stories. You know, Point de Hope is also another great one. And Len Lamel and those Rangers who got up the cliffs, you know, under enemy fire in 20 minutes, found those big guns back a mile back and spiked them. By 8:30, they were pointed. I've been right to that spot. They had a dead on sighting to Utah Beach. They could have destroyed that whole invasion. But yet it was 8:30. The invasion had started at 6:30, and there were no Germans around the guns. They were 100 yards away in the farmhouse. They couldn't figure that nobody was firing those big artillery pieces. Anyway, lots of stories. James knows a lot of them too.
One of those who landed at Utah Beach, I think, was Theodore Roosevelt Jr.
Yeah.
James.
So, Nick, the original concept that Dr. Ambrose had was a D-Day museum, correct?
That's correct, because of Higgin.
There was a guy who's actually didn't see any combat, but one of the most important people in D-Day was a gentleman by the name of Andrew Higgins. Could you tell our listeners, viewers, exactly who Andrew Higgins was and why he's such an important player in the whole D-Day story?
Well, it goes back to when Steve Ambrose first met, when he was editing the Eisenhower papers up at Johns Hopkins. He had occasion a couple of times to go out and meet with the former President Eisenhower and the former Supreme Commander. And Ambrose was asked by the general, former president, I see you're from New Orleans. Do you ever know Andrew Higgins? And Steve said, no, I didn't get to New Orleans till 1960. He died in the mid-50s. I never met him. He said, well, that's unfortunate, young man. He says, because that man in those boats, he's the man who won World War II. I mean, Ambrose's mouth must have hit the floor. There wasn't a school named after him, a street named after Higgins. And he employed 30,000 people, built 12,000 of those landing craft. And Eisenhower said, I'm not joking. They were the bridge to the beach. The Marines used them. Every service branch used them to every theater of the war, not just D-Day. There were 130-plus D-Days of World War II. We had no boats that could get men over an open beach. And the Japanese and the Nazis had basically controlled the geography of Southeast Asia, all the islands, and all of the 3,000 miles of coastline of Europe. So you had to get major forces on land. And Higgins was the guy who invented those boats at a time when the country had none. And that was the germination of the idea, because the research park, which I was leading, had a beach right there, Pontchartrain Beach. And that's where Higgins, one of the places he tested those landing craft. So Steve says, it's a historic site. Eisenhower said, he's the man who won the war. And, it's good enough for me. And he says, you're my pal. We're going to do this together. And he said, it only cost $1 million. I said, no, it's going to be at least $4 million, Steve. You don't know anything about these things. Well, 35 years later, and $450 million, we finished the World War II Museum downtown instead of there.
So at the end of this month, you and I are going to be headed to Innsbruck, Austria.
Yeah.
And why don't we and talk a little bit about what we're going to be doing there, and tell us a little bit about your academic background. We look at you and you say, well, Scott was a museum director. I think it's a little more substance than that. So let's chat a couple of those things on views.
Well, I began my teaching career as a young assistant professor at the University at LSU in New Orleans in 1969, and taught for 10 years European diplomatic history. Steve and I, Ambrose and I, taught some courses. He got the war, I got the peace, he always said. He says, the war is more interesting. I said, well, you're just a great teacher too, Steve. But anyhow, so became a dean and vice chancellor, and I was sort of the designated startup guy, but at the university. And I had started, one reason I came to the attention of the chancellor and a few other administrators, 1973, I started a summer school first in Munich, and then moved it to Innsbruck, Austria in 1976. It's a 6-week summer school with about 30, 45 courses, all for credit. Students from all over the country come in and just for summer only, as well as UNO students. And in 50 years, that program, which has about 250 students every summer, has had 12,000, probably 12,500 students who have gone through that program. It's the largest continuous academic summer school offered abroad by any American university. And I'm very proud of that, because it transforms and changes lives. And even the students coming from other parts of the country and other universities for the summer, I'd say half of those 12,000 students are all from New Orleans. So it's a big deal. But it's all about transforming lives through education and experiencing the museums and the art and the architecture and going to Normandy or the battle sites. There's nothing better than getting students right onto the place of the battles and see the great art. I mean, you're right a few hours from Venice and Vienna and Munich. You can see how the Nazis took over Germany and the rise and fall of the Third Reich, which is part of what I'm teaching, no surprise, I'm teaching this summer two courses, one on World War II, of course, and the other one is World War II and history and memory. Memory is a very contested thing. So that's a sophomore level. It's going to be a lot of fun, too, and exciting. So anyway, it's an immersive program, and it's been I think it ranks right up there with my achievements and Steve's with the development of the museum.
So the University of New Orleans, so people know, was opened under the administration of Governor L.K. Long, I think it was 1958.
Yeah.
It has never had a semester, a moment that it was segregated. This was way before James Meredith came, way before the University of Alabama was integrated. UNO was integrated in like 1958.
Right.
And if anybody listening to this is in any kind of philanthropic move, man, you could send a couple shekels to UNO, because they do really, really important work. They have probably have more first time in their family students going to college as maybe any other place in the country. And it's just a wonderful place with an extremely diverse and student body with a glorious history. So I'll take my hat off.
Thank you. Thank you for that. It's a chancellor search going on right now, and I'm chair of the search committee, and we're going to have get a great chancellor, and we're part of the LSU system again. We used to be, but it's a great urban public university with about 80,000 graduates and all various disciplines, and very proud of having at least I've had a role in this international education opportunities for our students, as well as the creation of the World War II Museum. And James has always been a big supporter and fan. And I don't know how many uncles you had in World War II, six?
Everyone, but there were five, but my dad had four siblings, all five of World War II.
Yeah, all five,
four
yes.
More officers, one won the Distinguished Air Cross, and air medal was all gunner in a B-17.
Yeah.
That was part of my family's history.
So James is going to be talking, I hope, with Clancy Dubose over
there. Oh, yeah, Clancy and John Martin and Betsy are coming, and we're going to be in Innsbruck. I'm looking forward to it. It's really a chance for me to do something for a great university and a great mission.
Great to have you there. Hoping to have a couple of weeks together.
Albert, if you can close us out.
Well, I'm going to go back to D-Day, Nick. Dwight Eisenhower was not a great strategic general, but he was a great leader. And that June 6th decision was courageous. That was gutsy. He wrote that famous memo in which he said that if it failed, the fault was his alone. That was kind of what we call these days the anti-Trump memo or the non-Trump memo. But I think this may seem a stretch, but he's really in many ways not dissimilar from George Washington, who also was not a great strategic general, but was an extraordinary leader.
There's a lot of commonalities there. What Eisenhower was a great leader because he could bring people together, listen to their advice, and make the hard decisions when he had to. And a decision to go was probably the biggest decision that any general had to make in world history, since it's arguably the most significant climactic global war in history, and that was one of the turning points. Is the hinge of the war was really D-Day, Normandy.
Yeah,
and at one moment, as Steve Ambrose used to say, before he made that decision, General Eisenhower was the most powerful man in the world. The moment he said, "Let's go," he was the least powerful man in the world because he had delegated all this authority and he had confidence in that whole team of the generals and admirals, and it's a great moment. We're developing a leadership program at the World War II Museum that's going to be built around D-Day for corporations as well as for students. So that'll come out of the Skunk Works in a year or two.
He had some great commanders, Matthew Ridgway and James Gavin and Bradley and others. Do you have in the museum that 1964 CBS special with Walter Cronkite, Eisenhower Returns to Normandy?
I'm pretty sure we have it. When he's sitting on the wall of the cemetery, I've seen that. That was a great moment, and there was hardly anybody there. Now there's hundreds, tens of thousands there on D-Day, and he sat there thinking about all the those kids buried in the cemetery there who didn't have a chance to come back and enjoy the fruits of the war and live lives and have kids and grandkids. And it was a great interview that Walter did.
Yeah, it was fabulous. Anybody out there, if you're traveling this summer, going anywhere, there's nothing better. You might stop by New Orleans and see the World War II Museum. It really is. It's special. And Nick, it is the official World War II Museum, correct?
By an act of Congress in 2004. We were riding high then. We had some money. We had a master plan. But as Mike Tyson says, Katrina came right next, and Tyson says, everybody's got a plan until you get punched in the mouth. And so we were out of business the next year for 2 or 3 years. So
well.
Anyways, great. So I would say also, if they come to New Orleans, come see the museum. If you're in Europe this summer, come down and see me and James in Innsbruck.
James?
No, just I can't wait to see you in Austria, Nick. And is our World War II museum, is that the third most visited museum in the country? Did I hear that? Or am I right?
Yeah, it varies. It's a TripAdvisor polls. It's a popularity poll. We've been anywhere from 3 to 5 or 6, depending on the year. We've always been the number one attraction in New Orleans from the day we opened. We've also ranked in the top 10 in the world among museums, too. I mean, ahead of the Louvre and lots of others, because they calculate this by the people who voluntarily who use TripAdvisor, and then they mail in their comments, and this is a superlative restaurant or museum or whatever it might be.
Anybody that hadn't been, I highly, highly recommend it. It can get kind of crowded. You can go in the summertime. There's a Higgins Hotel right across the street. So you don't have to, if you don't like the heat and humidity, it doesn't bother me. You can go right.
Our hotel, so our conference center. We have a big international World War II conference every November, about the week before Thanksgiving.
Well, thank you, man. I'll see you in Innsbruck.
All right. We'll have a beer together.
Nick, thank you again. Hey, now for the outrage of the week. 60 Minutes, the most successful broadcast television program, good hard-hitting journalism, huge audience, is being torn apart, or in the words of correspondent Scott Pelley, it's being murdered. Pelley was fired, as were two other top correspondents, Sharon Alfonsi and Cecilia Vega, and a number of executives, and Anderson Cooper just left. Barry Wise, the relatively new and over-her-head president of CBS News, is driven by ideology against what she sees as woke Democrats and unwavering support for Israel, and a desire to please her bosses, the Ellisons, big pals of Donald Trump. Everything she has touched has failed. The CBS Evening News is in the tank since she reshaped it. She allowed Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to choose which correspondent was to interview him. Now she has her sights on 60 Minutes. She chose some guy named Nick Bolton with no television experience to take over 60 Minutes. He explained the reason, after a contentious meeting, the reason that Pelley, a CBS veteran who has covered wars, the White House, anchored the evening news, where his audience rose, in contrast to the Weiss area, and for years done great work on 60 Minutes, he was fired because he was disrespectful to Bolton. Mr. Bolton, in journalism, I just want to tell you, respect is something you earn. That's something that neither you nor Miss Wise deserve. It's just so tragic what's happened to a great television news program.
Well, thank you. Every now and then is an expression that a blind squirrel can find an acorn. This show, I think, has done some things I'm very proud of. Didn't know it at the time, was glad we did it. When we had Chas Mulder, the mayor of Columbia, Tennessee, who's announced and is running against Andy Ogles, the incumbent, in the 5th Congressional District of Tennessee. Maybe you didn't see this. Maybe you should see this. Mr. Ogles stated that gays have no place in America. Yeah, let me get that through your head. This man, a member of the United States Congress of the United States of America from the 5th Congressional District of Tennessee, said gays have no place in America. Now, I don't know if anybody's sexual identity is their business, but Ms. Weiss has been very forthcoming that she's, I don't know, bisexual, what the fuck, I mean, who cares, if it should matter to anybody. And this is the kind of people that you're fucking hanging around with, all right? This guy was brought up in America. He went to schools there, communities, he goes to church there, and he sat there and actually said, gay people have no place in America. And maybe we've become so immune to outrage because there's so much to be outraged about. But this motherfucker is out of his mind. He has no place in the Congress. Any political party would excommunicate him, throw him out on his ass. And any Republican that sits there, they give him any money, understand, there is no place for gay people in America. Oh, man, go fuck yourself.
You know, he earlier had said, James, that all Muslims should be deported.
Sure.
Oh, so he's going to get rid of gay people, Muslims, who's next?
Yeah, who knows, man? But I mean, yeah. This guy, by his own action, his own words, how does he stay in the Congress? I don't know. But it's just unbelievable. Gays have no place in America. Oh,
well, he's also been under both criminal investigation and is still being reviewed by the ethics panel. If you want to list the worst members of Congress, he's at least in the top 10.
What about Graham Platner? I can just hear the bullshit. What about Graham Platner? All right?
Maybe this guy's a real American.
Shit. He's put me started.
Listener questions now. James, our first question is from Gordon in Norwood, Michigan, who I think has asked good questions in the past. He said, why is the Democratic Party, which is so loaded with common sense talent at the candidate level, incapable of tapping similar talent to run the national and, in some cases, the state local party bureaucrats?
Well, I don't know that it matters who runs it. And I think Democratic politicians tend to view the DNC as just an impediment or something that they would spend a lot of time on. And I've kind of defended Ken Martin for this thing. It's an impossible place. And I don't think they're good for much else than putting on a convention and doing some things that they have to do. That is not what bothers me. But what I really want to say about the Democratic Party is, man, the political talent that we have coming online, the political talent that has been displayed. I mean, I'm talking about Paige Cognetti, talking about Chas Mulder, talking about the different people that we have on here. It's really, really remarkable. And, you know, I think worrying about or trying to reform or do anything with the DNC is, for the most part, a waste of time.
Yeah, I agree. Charles in Christchurch, New Zealand.
No,
oh, I love to hear from our New Zealand.
I got the South Island, but
he says, why do you both think Kamala is an unviable candidate? If Joe had backed her earlier, she may have won. Charles, on this one, we're not on the same page. I thought she was a bad candidate in 2024. I thought she was a bad candidate in 2019. Terrible candidate when she at one point was thought to have a good chance to get the nomination until she campaigned. I think if Joe had gotten out earlier, which he should have a year earlier, I think there would have been an open contest. I don't think she would have won. And I don't think she's a viable candidate in 2028. I hope she doesn't run.
You know, Vice President Harris was the district attorney for San Francisco, major city, who's the attorney general of California, say a major state would be an understatement, largest state in the country. She was then the United States Senator from California. Okay, it's pretty stout. Then she was vice president. That's really stout. And then she was the uncontested nominee of her party. That's not, you know what? She's had an incredible political career. Literally 99.98572% of any politician would give their right arm to have a career that successful. I do not feel sorry for her. You had the greatest gift that anybody can have. You had a chance. And I don't see any possibility that the Democrats are going to go back to 2024. They just don't want anything to do it. I don't think the average here people don't dislike you or anything like that. They respect what you've done. But exit, stage left, stage right, I don't care. is just, you've had a real, real profound political career. And who knows, maybe as a Democratic president, they'll appoint you to the Supreme Court. You couldn't do no worse than what the fuck we got there now.
Annie in Edina, Minnesota, brings up a good question, James. She basically saying is, how do we parlay the corruption issue? Do people care about corruption now? Yeah. And I will say there are new polls indicating that it has become much more of a pressing issue than it was before. But boy, there's a lot of material out there.
Boy, is there. And it's right. People have been aware of it. I tell you, the elite, but let me assure you, among certain people in journalism and around it, are totally attuned to this issue. And I'm just waiting for the New York Times to drop a 5-part series on the depth of this corruption. I don't know that they're doing it. No one said, "Oh, go off your fucking rocker." Schlossberg or whatever. No one told me this, but I know it's coming. The other thing is, I know that Maggie Haven Johnson Swan's book is coming, right? Because it asked me for my address to send me one. And I would, just knowing who Maggie and Johnson Swan was, I think corruption is going to be pretty central to that book. And there's more and more coming out. And boy, the corruption is beyond anything you've ever done. I was talking to Norm Eisen, the ethics lawyer, and it might be that there's been more corruption under the administration of Donald Trump than there's in the other 249-year history of the United States. I don't know.
I think that's an easy one. No yeah. question. Kathleen in Houston, Texas, says about James Tallarico, can he win the Senate seat without taking PAC money? He said he won't take it. Can he win it without it? Yes, he can. He'll yeah. raise lots of money. The Republicans will pour tons of money in there. They will have more money than he has, but he will have more than enough to be competitive. And I don't think he needs PAC money, and it gives him a little bit of an edge on an issue, particularly when he's running against such a corrupt Republican candidate. So, yes, I think Tallarico can win without taking PAC money. It's going to be tough, and it's going to be close, but he has a shot.
Yeah. Josh Turner doesn't take PAC money either. That's becoming an increasingly common thing. I've hit a detest Citizens United. I think money in politics is a huge issue. And, you know, the PAC money or whatever, but it's symbolic, but it's an important part of symbolism to say, you know, I don't like it, I'm not going to take it. And it's not right. as much of it. It doesn't count near as much as people think compared to other things that you do. And, you know, a law firm may have a PAC, but they say, oh, I'm not going to take the PAC money. Okay, well, we'll get all the partners to put up money and give it to you directly. I don't dismiss it as being grandstanding. It has some symbolic value.
Yeah. No, I agree. And look, I think the Texas race is close. That's a hell of a victory for Democrats. And, you know, I think those people say, hey, there's no way you can win in Texas.
No, that's
that was a pretty valid observation for the last 20 years. But I think a combination of a good Democratic candidate, a good year, and a really rotten Republican candidate, there's a chance.
Yeah, I do too. And you know, he has a chance, trust me. But it's an act of hygiene to send Tallarico a check. You'll feel better about yourself.
Yeah.
It's pure.
James, I think I'm getting all these right because they're such good questions. And I think the next is from Ed in El Sobrante, California. And Ed says, I thought Israel was at war with Iran. Why are they not present in Iran-U.S. negotiation tables?
Because Bibi's got Trump's number. And even I think Trump has come to realize that he got, you know, stuck in this because he paid attention to him. But I don't know. You can't if I get started on how much I loathe the current government of Israel and how much I loathe some of the policies that I don't even think are necessary. I might get too emotional here. But, you know, our friend Jim Gerstein, we got to get him on his show pretty fast. Thinks the next election might bass some good news for Israel and the United States. So we'll see.
Yeah. Roger in Madison, Wisconsin. God, I love Madison. He says, could you please give us a quick recap on why you rate the DNC so badly? But he notes that Judy and I were there last year for the Madison Capital Times Idea Fest. But Roger says he still kicks himself for not seeing us. Roger, you were missed. But that Idea Fest out there, which Dave Marinus plays a huge role in, and he told me that they're going to have better guests this year. So, Roger, make sure you go to the Idea Fest. The DNC is just worthless is probably not an accurate description, but I guess the only real responsibility they have is to arrange primaries and the like. They certainly, the autopsy screw up was an embarrassment. There are other places that matter a great deal more. James, I'm supposed to ask you a question. And the reason I saved this, because it's from Shreveport, Louisiana. I like to give you the questions from Louisiana. Uh-huh. And it's Nathaniel. He starts off talking about Tallarico, which we just discussed, and whether he has a chance. But he says, what are the chances of a Democrat winning any of the other seven statewide races in Texas? We're not just talking about Tallarico, talking about attorney general and also some of the congressional races.
I'll confess something. I'm insufficiently informed, but I will ask around this week and try to give you a better answer than that. I apologize, but I really don't know what's going on in the AG's race in Texas.
Yeah,
but I will find out. And let's put that question on hold. I will say this to my friend in Freeport. I was talking to a very knowledgeable political journalist this morning, and I made the case that the day after the election in November, people are going to go, shit, why didn't we get a really good candidate in Louisiana? And when I see these primary results, but I go, Mr. Jamie Davis, who's from Tensaw Parish, I hope Jamie can raise some money, because I think Louisiana, just like anything else, and boy, you look at the turnout numbers from the primary, particularly look at the black number, I don't care what happens, we're not going to lose Louisiana by double digits in the Senate race. And Jeff Landry is just unpopular.
You mean the ambassador to Greenland?
I mean the ambassador to Greenland. It's like staggering. And they did a thing, and you'll love this, Al. They cut 200,000 people from health insurance. And they're trying to argue that's a good thing. In deep poorest, and by and large, the sickest state in the United States, we now take pride that we could give ripping health insurance away from pregnant women. I mean, but we're a great Catholic state and we're all great moral people. That makes me goddamn, I don't want to steer on this. I'll just get in trouble.
Well, listen, those questions are great. If we didn't get to yours this week, please send them in again next week. We'll try to get to them. It's awful tough to winnow them down. And finally, don't forget to participate in our survey. Send them back, whether the founding fathers would send back some of the current Trump administration officials, send them back to England or not. So you can do that. You can look at the survey link in our episode show notes. Thanks for listening. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Delete Me, Quince, Hers, WL, and 3 Day Blinds in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting it, because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. Now, remember, I want you to remember to vote for which member of the Trump administration you think is so bad that the founding fathers would have sent them back to England, by answering using the survey link in the episode show notes. The polls are open for the next month, and we'll announce the winner the week of July 4th, so make sure we hear from you. You also can find other shows you might enjoy in the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. And remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.